I'm Mike Stopforth, and this is The One-Eyed Man, a show where I talk to talented people doing meaningful work at the intersection of leadership, technology, and impact. Thanks to those of you who are return listeners, of course, and if you're here for the first time, a big welcome from my side. My guest in this episode is Professor Greg Fisher. Greg is the Larry and Barbara Shaw Professor of Entrepreneurship at the Kelly School of Business in Indiana University. I dare you to say that three times fast. He is also a visiting lecturer at the Gordon Institute of Business Science at Gibbs in South Africa, where I know him from. And more recently, the author of a fantastic book titled The Principles of Entrepreneurial Progress. This is a book that catalogues 12 principles that help create and sustain momentum when launching startups, gathered from Greg's experience teaching and coaching entrepreneurs for over two decades. In this episode, we talk about the idea for the book and how it came about, some of the processes of putting the publication and the research together, and then we dive into some of the more pertinent principles for entrepreneurs in our South African context. I love chatting to Greg, not just in this episode, but in general, because as much as his life and career is rooted in the US and that market and its way of thinking about capital and entrepreneurship and growth, his heart is very much South African. And so he's able to quite uniquely, I think, contextualize his insights for an extremely broad range of entrepreneurs and entrepreneurship challenges. I hope you enjoy the conversation as much as I did.
Well, in essence, this has been a pretty long journey. I've been, you know, studying entrepreneurship essentially since 2007, which is when I did my PhD. The actual book. So I've been a researcher, often consulting, often working with entrepreneurs. Mm. But the book comes about as a result of, I guess, a couple of influences. Number one is I became quite frustrated myself with giving other people advice and trying to know what could I tell them that would really be meaningful when, and most of the time it's MBA students or undergrad students who've got a business idea. And I was trying to figure out what could I tell them that would really be meaningful. And I often would give them one little tidbit of advice or another little tidbit of advice, but I started collecting what I thought were the core nuggets that either come from my own experience, that come from the research, and that can be packaged up in a way that they could potentially use. And I initially wrote it up as a bit of a blog post that got a whole lot of traction. And I thought, but there's more here. I want to be able to put tools with some of these principles. I want to be able to tell deeper stories related to each. And so I eventually packaged it up as a book proposal. And part of doing a book is you send it out as a proposal and a publisher will agree to do it. And then you're on the clock. And then I had to pull it all together. But that was certainly a super fun exercise.
So it's tempting, looking at the title of the book, to assume that this is only for that category of people that have an idea for a startup, that are at the beginning of their journey and want to know how not to mess up, basically. But my experience, certainly of the first part of the book, is that this is really for anyone who is anywhere on their entrepreneurial journey and interested in being introspective and critical about that journey. There is gold in all of these principles that you denoted for people in, I guess, any stage of the entrepreneurial journey. Is that fair?
Yeah, I guess I framed it around the idea that part of being on this journey is figuring out how to make progress. And it can get quite overwhelming. And I talk about sort of uncertainty, ambiguity, resource constraints, all impinging on one's ability to know what to do when trying to start a business, grow a business, scale a business to its next market or whatever it might be. And so when you're under resource constraints and you don't have everything you need, when you're faced with uncertainty about whether decisions are going to work or not work, whether sort of all the information you're getting is highly ambiguous, knowing what to do just to make progress from on a single day or in a single week or in a single month can be hugely challenging. And so what I try and answer in this book is, what are some of the pragmatic things one can do to make progress on that journey? And so very often the book appeals, or the ideas in the book appeal, to people who have already started and maybe are reflecting, am I on the right path? What should I be doing over the next few weeks, next few months, to really figure out how to move in a productive way along that path? Because it's a tenuous, messy path to be on, to be starting a business of any size, whether it's as you're doing a grappling studio, whether you've starting a highly scalable agency, or whether it's a new technology application or whatever it might be. You know, it's just a messy journey. And what I'm trying to do is break through the noise and say, these are concrete things you can do to reflect whether you're on a productive path and what you can do to keep moving along that path.
You alluded to these three conditions or states, I guess, that every entrepreneur, every business owner, every decision maker, you might argue, is presented with as they navigate, you know, kind of the oncoming tide of decision making. You spoke about constraints in resources. You spoke about ambiguity and uncertainty. Where did that framework come from? I understand that that underpins the 12 principles that you've identified in the book, but where did those three sort of key conditions come from?
So those are really an intersection of academic entrepreneurship and what I see pragmatically out in the world. So a big in the research world. So, you know, there's this whole bunch of professors all over the world who are studying what entrepreneurs do, how they do things, what makes them successful and not successful. And a big part of framing up that work is often, why should we study entrepreneurship and new venture creation as something separate from traditional management? And those are three levers that often, or perspectives that often get invoked, that sort of distinguish a lot of what happens in the entrepreneurial world. This sort of idea that you make decisions, but there's very little, you can't probabilistically determine what's going to happen from those decisions. Yeah. It's uncertain. And the more novelty embedded in your idea, the greater the level of uncertainty. That in an age of information, any information you do get can often sort of point in multiple different directions and can be somewhat ambiguous. And then the sort of idea of resource constraints, that part of the challenge entrepreneurs face compared to people in established organizations is that they often don't have all the resources they need. So borrowing it from there, but then also there's a bunch of other stuff they might say in the academic literature that I don't think is as concretely relevant to what people face on a day-to-day basis. But I sort of see those as creating a really complex cocktail of conditions that people starting a business, trying to scale a business, face on a regular basis.
So it's only been my experience that sometimes knowledge isn't power. And sometimes ignorance can really be bliss. If I think back to the early stages of starting Cerebra, that was a terrible decision at the time. I should never have done that. It was ill-informed. But sometimes the less you know, the better it is, because you're willing to take risks and perhaps attempt things that with, you know, age and experience, I use in inverted commas, you might not attempt. And I've certainly experienced some of that analysis paralysis, as it were, now in the later stages of my life, when you are, I guess, a little bit more conservative in your thinking. My question is, in the 2 decades that you've been interacting with, studying and researching entrepreneurs in this accelerating age of information that has run concurrent with that, do you feel like the world that we're in right now, specifically through the lens of the entrepreneur, is more ambiguous and more uncertain, or is that getting better as we have access to more information? I'm interested in your analysis of the relationship between those two things.
So I'll come to that relationship in a moment, but I just want to go back to what you said previously. I think if most entrepreneurs knew what they were getting themselves into before starting a business, we just would have very little new venture creation in the world.
Sure.
I mean, I think the reality is that for most people, it is harder. They do need sort of a inflated sense of self and of the likelihood of success just to take those steps. And it's in taking those steps that you start to discover what can work and doesn't work and so on. So going back to that point, I think it's an incredibly relevant point, and a point that, you know, if you do find yourself trying to do too much planning and too much prediction of what the future might look like, you might actually be impeding your entrepreneurial journey. Like, there's some forethought that can be somewhat valuable, but too much of it is invariably going to impinge on your inclination to take action, your likelihood of trying things out and experimenting, your willingness to take risks. And so you'll end up losing a whole lot of that. Now, on the notion of there being more information available and it being more ambiguous to some extent, I think that the environment for starting a business has changed. And for the most part, it's gotten easier. I think the concept of calling yourself an entrepreneur and assuming that as an identity has elevated in society. So it's more okay now to say, this is what I'm going to do, as opposed to becoming a doctor or a lawyer or something else. That's helped. I think that access to technology and the ability to access technology relatively inexpensively has helped a lot. So whether that's, you know, just simple things like cloud computing and being able to buy off the shelf technology and assemble that together has helped a lot. But that sort of mitigates some of the resource constraint pieces. But I do think that because there are sort of more options of ways to do things, the sort of idea of ambiguity and uncertainty has to some extent increased. And the disruptive AI phase is just radically exacerbating that. Like, we don't know today what the successful businesses of the really big successful businesses of tomorrow are going to look like, just because there's this whole notion of artificial intelligence coming in, and it's just got so many different paths down which things could go, that I think the notion of uncertainty and ambiguity has ramped up, but the opportunity for disruption has also ramped up, which means that there are more sort of channels down which entrepreneurs could potentially go and find quite big success down the line. So I don't know that there's a perfectly clear like relationship going on, but I do think access to resources is not as big of an issue anymore, but sort of the ambiguity around options you could take as an entrepreneur are probably greater.
I'm reminded of a conversation I had around a campfire with friends of mine recently, more of a debate than a conversation, but it was a debate around whether or not music's actually getting better or worse. This conversation around, you know, there's no great music anymore. And my point was, there's plenty of great music. It's just there's also plenty of really mediocre music. And the great music possibly is getting hidden amongst the – I actually wrote about this a while back. When the barrier to entry for creation is lower, you get a far greater influx of mediocrity and truly special, truly great also sometimes constraints force greatness out of the mix. So it's an interesting debate back and forth. And I wonder if we apply that to business, what that means for a conversation around entrepreneurs and talking about – you know, the oncoming tide of AI, and we don't know what the next generation of disruptive businesses will even look like or what they'll do. There's something about how that has put an emphasis back on brilliant basics, just absolutely pure application to, you know, some of the core principles that you've identified or that we all know are so much a part of what makes the businesses that we rely on the most reliable. And yet, you know, those aren't the things that get the headlines. I mean, we contracted very recently here at home with a gentleman who cleans carpets and cleans upholstery and couches. And I was overwhelmed with the positivity of the experience from start to finish. And it just came down to brilliant basics, great communication, great service, being on time, keeping you updated, the professionalism of the experience, the little extras that were thought about, the application to just the passion of this is not a particularly attractive or sexy industry, but, you know, applying themselves with real passion. And I was like, wow, like there is so much space for brilliant basics. I'm interested in your thoughts around that or your comments around that.
Well, one of the principles I talk about in the book, I call the simplicity principle. And it sort of echoes the notion that part of getting things right as a new business is going down to the simple core of what are you doing and why is it valuable? So trying to strip away all fancy discussion of, you know, complex models. Are we going to do things in a completely disruptive way? Are we going to, you know, change this industry? And saying, what at its core, what problem are you solving at the core? Yeah. Who's got
what is
that
it you
problem?
Actually and do how, for your customers, yeah.
Yeah, and how are you doing that as simply as possible? And so I do think that that is part of making progress in the early days is stripping away and saying, at its core, what does someone who wants their carpets cleaned want? They want good communication. They want reliability and on-time delivery. And they want to a simple, seamless just experience. And if you can do that, then they'll tell their friends about it. Then they'll tweet about it. They'll do whatever. But if you don't get that right, trying to say we've got a customer service platform that can connect you and ensure your carpets into the future. And it's just not going to be meaningful.
It's moving your couch. Yeah.
You just got to get down to the core of what they're doing. And so that's one of the things I try and isolate in the book. And there are off the shelf technologies, whether it's using WhatsApp or whatever sort of speaks to the customer, that can allow you to do those things really well. So it's easier to do some of the core things well, but a lot of people forget that because they want to do the sexy stuff. They want to do the complex stuff. They want to be sort of differentiated in some other kind of grand vision way. But I'm a total believer in sort of getting back down to the core.
Yeah, I love that point. One of the questions I ask clients to ruminate on when facilitating conversations around digital transformation, which are always tricky because it's always around the next technological silver bullet or how software can help fix our problems for us. And the question I ask is specifically when it comes to analyzing the competitive market and where the next disruption might come from is this, what is the problem you are solving for your customers? And it is terrifying how few people can answer that succinctly, especially the big banks, big financial services providers, telcos. What is the problem you are actually solving for your customer? And then the follow-on question is, what is the most interesting alternative or creative way to solve that problem? Because that's where the Airbnb comes from. Is, you know, the problem that the hotel industry is solving is, do you have a safe place for me to sleep for the night that isn't my home? Right? Yep. That's the problem. Not how do we maximize building occupancy? That's not the problem you're solving for me. That's the problem you're solving for you, not for me. And it's easy to get distracted by that, especially at that kind of scale. I'm curious, Greg, how do you hope and dream that business owners and entrepreneurs will use your book? How do you imagine or fantasize that it will be applied in reality? How do you hope it gets unpacked and understood?
I hope, you know, people who are embarking on this journey, have embarked on this journey, are planning at some point in the future to embark on this journey, will pick up the book and will sort of work through it, read it, and appreciate all 12 of the principles, and then sort of put it away as a quick reference. So it will be easily accessible on their desk, or because the idea behind the book is that entrepreneurial progress depends on what I frame as these micro bursts of progress. We like to think of it as the smooth upward trajectory that you see on a PowerPoint slide, where you start with low revenues and you increase in scale in a perfectly linear fashion over time. The reality is that it's a messy, squiggly, scribbly line that looks like a two-year-old drawing that's gone wrong. And amidst that messiness, trying to know and trying to have something you can lean on that's going to give you a perspective or insight that allow you to make progress that day, that week, that month, I think pulling on this book and saying, which principle do I need to be applying based on the issues I'm currently facing? So if it's an issue around developing your first prototype, how can I apply the prototype principle? Or if I don't know whether something's going to work, could I build a prototype and sort of experiment with it and iterate and adapt in response to that? If you're struggling to convey to others what you're doing, could you invoke the storytelling principle and sort of tell, craft a more clear and compelling story about what you're doing? If you're struggling to figure out like a revenue and business model, could you use the integration principle to conceptualize your business as more of a holistic business model and sort of figure out how that all works? So it's sort of on this journey, you're going to be faced with these sort of challenges, and you might not immediately know what the challenge is, but having the book at your disposal and the 12 principles will not only help you recognize, oh, this is something I could work on, but also illustrate to you how you could work on it, like provide tools and perspectives of what you can do to sort of make that micro burst of progress in and amidst that the messiness of starting a business.
I love that idea of it being a playbook of sorts that you can access very quickly in a, you know, chapter kind of format to go, this is the thing that I'm feeling pain around right now. How do I remind myself? How do I refresh that thinking? And speaking of thinking, you've alluded to four of the 12 principles, I think, if my count is correct so far. So you spoke about simplicity, you spoke about storytelling, you spoke about the integration principle very briefly. You also spoke about the prototyping principle and its power. I'm curious, because there must have been in your research, in thinking about this as much as you have, in the conversations that you've had with dozens, maybe hundreds of people on this journey, there must have been some very clear golden threads that you were able to scribble down on a piece of paper straight away and go, okay, those are the bankable ones. I'm really interested in what surprised you. What were the principles that perhaps you didn't expect would be part of your conversation up front that you grew an affinity for as you navigated through the research and as the book evolved in its capacity?
I've put the principles into buckets. So the first six are all value creation principles, and they're quite closely tied with sort of some of the thinking around lean startup methodology and so on. But packaged, I think, in an even more accessible way. And then supporting that, those six value creation principles are two sets of principles in three other buckets. And the ones around action, entrepreneurial action, the others around resourcing, and the third is around sort of what I call big picture principles. And the resourcing ones have always intrigued me from even my days of trying to start a business and trying to work out, where would I get resources from? How much should I depend on outside versus inside resources? And a big thing I see tripping up MBA students all the time is they say, well, if I can get my business funded, I'll start it. Or if I can attract outside investment, then I'll build the product. And I've always, just over my time of researching, that's always the sort of relationship between resources and action has intrigued me. And one of the sort of notions that comes out in some of the entrepreneurship literature is what's called the affordable loss principle. And that's, instead of framing that this is how much I need to start my business and I will only start if I can get that, you frame it as how much are you willing to spend on getting your business started? And if you lost that, you would still be okay. And it like forces you to reflect more on what do you bring to the equation in terms of time, money, energy, connections, things that are already built, assets you've got on hand. And what of those are you actually willing to put into like a business account, so to speak, a fictitious or a account that you can put in this business? And even if the business doesn't work out, you'll still be okay. And it's a way of reframing this sort of notion around resources. And I've seen it be incredibly powerful for people to rethink, instead of what do I need from the outside? What have I got on the inside that I can afford to lose? And if I set it aside, I will see how I can use that to now build the business. So the affordable loss principle is the principle of asking yourself the question, what have I got on hand that I can afford to lose in order to get this business started? And it opens up all sorts of ways of working from what you've got as opposed to what you need.
Suppose there's also an interesting point there around how these principles land in different geographies, because an entrepreneur reading this in a Starbucks in Silicon Valley might interpret that resource principle through quite different lenses to, say, somebody sitting in Etowah, in the East Rand of South Africa. I mean, obviously will, but the conversation around resource allocation, resource access, access to capital, but not just access to capital, access to talent, access to networks, access to, you know, market readiness, it's profoundly interesting how different that can be from one arena to the next. But I really do believe if we accept that, barring that very small bubble of the Silicon Valley narrative of, like, if it's a good enough idea, you seek a round of funding and we scale from there and maybe one day make some profit. For most people, it goes back to that principle of prototype. What is the easiest way to test that this works? Put it into practice, learn as much as humanly possible, and then iterate from there. How did you avoid the temptation? Obviously, being based in the US, where some of that narrative really is about big capital allocation, VC, and so on. How did you avoid the temptation of getting stuck in that narrative when that is the bulk of your market and a lot of the narrative is around bigger, better, more, and scale?
I have fallen into that trap in my teaching, in my sort of framing up of things for students and for people who come chat to me, and even in some of my own thinking around starting businesses, is that, you know, we're in this place where theoretically there are VC funds looking for deals and so on. And the reality is I'm at a sort of top 20 business school, and, sure, you know, one or two students a year might get funding 3 years post-graduation. So The reality for most people starting businesses is they're not going to go out and get VC funding. And so I've had to scale back and say, what's really valuable, even for people in this market, but especially when going back to South Africa and teaching at Gibbs or going into some other market domain, what's really valuable and what really moves the needle around resourcing and thinking about how you resource a business and how you move it forward. And a big part of it is sort of, number one, breaking that mentality that resourcing, the primary source of resourcing is venture capitalists and angel investors, or angel investors and venture capitalists.
Yes.
And they're sort of a much more secondary, nice to have. But even to get, especially for people who aren't in the heart of Silicon Valley, maybe, you know, it's the, if they haven't done a startup before or they haven't worked at Google. So if you're not in that elite category, you're probably going to have, number one, built quite a lot. Number two, utilized your own resources. Number three, experimented and got some data to show that whatever you're proposing is working, even if you do want to get venture capital. So the sort of notion that these principles might not apply as much because there might be venture capital involved, that the idea that you can sort of scribble an idea on the back of a napkin or come up with a concept and go and pitch it to VCs is really not true unless you have had a massive exit or have got a huge reputation in Silicon Valley. So it is tempting, you're right, to fall into the trap of doing case studies of people who've, you know, gone
unicorned
out and just pitched their idea, the unicorn sort of. But the reality is for most people, that's not the journey. And I think this book is a really good antidote to that because it sort of tells you pragmatically what to do when that is not the most likely path you're going to take.
And this anecdote might tell you a little bit more about my personality than anything else. But I had such a fascinating conversation with Brent Shaheem, who's one of the people I look up to an extraordinary amount here in the South African advertising industry, and was a big part of the influence on my thinking, certainly in the early and middle stages of Cerebra, had a role to play in the deal that we did. And I was talking to him about starting another business. And I sat down with him to coffee, and I was talking about going about sourcing funding, fully expecting Brent to go, well, you know, if you're looking at raising some money, I know some people, I might be interested, because yeah, I've had an exit, I've got a decent rep. And Brent just looked at me and said, are you asking for money? I was like, yeah, maybe. Like, I'd be interested in maybe kind of, you know, starting a conversation. Or he's like, you don't need a round. You don't need money. You're a services guy. You need to start. Like, yeah. You need a client. You need revenue. That's, you know. And it was humbling on two levels, because I had also had the experience of having someone invest money up front, and realizing that dynamic didn't work as well for the services industry space, and can often be almost counterintuitive in its incentive. And it was a proper wake up moment for me, that was like, I'd also kind of fallen prey to that narrative of that's the only way to get going. The only way to get going is this capital. And it certainly has been proven wrong in my personal experience. But really interesting how this book and the lessons that are consistent throughout should work in any market, in any conditions, and especially when it's adverse, especially when it's hard. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've tried to get down to the core of saying these should be consistent or relevant or impactful in a diverse array of situations. Because the motivation was to get down to the essence of what moves the needle, not just what moves the needle if this, if that, if this. So it's maybe in some senses, some people will find it, oh, well, each of these principles in and of themselves are relatively simple, and maybe, and probably even for many people, common sense. The challenge is we often overlook that common sense, and we don't have a framework to remind ourselves of that common sense in the moments where we really need it.
So for those principles that aren't maybe as obvious or common sense, you mentioned that there were a few that sort of emerged as maybe even counterintuitive in the research. Which principles do you experience, or have you come to understand, are the hardest for entrepreneurs to grasp, maintain, commit to, whatever it might be, as they embark on that journey?
I mean, one of the things I do now with many of my students who take my classes is we sort of do a self-assessment of the 12 principles and people's sort of resonance or inclination to use them over the 12 or 16 week period of the class and so on. And one of the things I found is that it is very personal as to what you connect with and find comes more naturally, and what you find you've actually got to remind yourself of or forget about. So it's not necessarily, oh, just this one, or this one. One of the things I find MBAs struggle with is we've got a principle called the hustle principle, which is the idea that from an action standpoint, what entrepreneurs do to move the needle is they operate with a sense of a combination of urgency and unorthodoxy. And I've written quite a lot about hustle in the academic literature and sort of developed scales and shown that it correlates with success and so on. So I've come at it or partly from an academic standpoint, but we've shown that it really works well in practical scenarios. And MBA students, which is a lot of the people I spend time with, actually struggle to what we call hustle. And hustle is this notion that when you're confronted with a challenge, you work quite quickly with a sense of energy and urgency to solve that challenge, but you're also willing to do so with a sense of, with a notion of unorthodoxy in ways that might not be obvious, and just try things out and see what works. And we find that, and it's sort of the counter to, I'm going to plan and map exactly how I'm going to solve this challenge, and it's going to take a period of iterations and steps. It's more just, what can I do today to try and plug this hole, and let's see how things go. And they struggle to invoke the concept of hustle, partially because their training and their mindset is that you don't invest before you've done an NPV calculation and before you've got buy-in from all your stakeholders and before
comprehensive 32-page sort of, business plan. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's sort of the counter to that, and that's what holds them up. Now in South Africa, I find people tend to hustle quite a lot and be willing to hustle to make things work just because it's sort of part of the culture of society. So that's less of an issue there. In South Africa, frankly, one of the big things I think entrepreneurs often overlook is what problem am I solving? And they come up with they've seen a nice way of doing things abroad and they want to bring that to South Africa, or I've thought of a nice feature for how we might improve something, but they haven't thought concretely enough about what's principle number one in the book, which is the notion of the problem principle, which is that starting a business is about solving a problem. And if you don't know what problem you're solving, you don't know who has that problem, where they have it, when they have it, and why it exists, and what are the sort of alternative options they've currently got for solving it, then you're starting from a very weak foundation. And so in a South African context, I find just taking people trying to start a business back to that and helping them frame that up, then everything starts to fall in place.
Greg, there are a lot of listeners of the show that are in the marketing and advertising space. Which of the principles kind of connect with that audience the deepest? Do you think people who are communicators by nature and are really interested in understanding the parts of the entrepreneurial momentum mix that they're going to be most naturally drawn to?
Well, the storytelling principle is sort of falls directly into their wheelhouse, if you will. So the storytelling principle is that most successful entrepreneurs have figured out how to tell their story. And sometimes it's through a matter of trial and error. Sometimes it comes more naturally to them. And if they don't figure it out, then often they're bumping up against difficulties and challenges, because as someone who's trying to do something that's new, that's different, that's alternative, that hasn't quite been done in the past, you're very often either selling yourself to customers, selling yourself to partners or suppliers, selling yourself to investors, selling yourself to potential employees to try and bring them on board and make risk. And so to be able to tell a compelling story about what you do and why you do it is like a superpower, and that superpower can really move the needle on with respect to how you interface with so many different stakeholders. So one of the things we go through in the book is why storytelling is important, how to uncover and distill a story, an entrepreneurial story or story around starting a business, and where and when to tell that story so that you leverage its impact.
Oh, wonderful. That's amazing. I'm sure that's something that many marketing agencies wish their clients could do better as well, because just connecting with that clarity makes that job immensely easier. So I mentioned the marketing and advertising audience. Now, there's another audience that I think is quite interesting to speak about specifically as it pertains to how they might use the book, and that's the proverbial intrapreneur, somebody who finds themselves in the corporate environment, not a pure entrepreneur per se, although I don't necessarily find that a helpful, I find that often the conversation around that is quite diminishing, which is unfair and certainly not helpful. People who feel that they are entrepreneurial, but within the corporate infrastructure and ecosystem, how is the book useful to them?
So it's interesting. I am the second half of February will be going to South Korea to teach a program that we are joint partners with SKKU, a university in South Korea, and I'm teaching a corporate innovation class. And they've asked me to do exactly that, to take ideas from the book, but to reorientate them towards people who want to be more intrapreneurial. So stay within their existing corporation. And really, you know, what I've discovered and so I've been reflecting on this, and I'll probably do a blog post or something about it going forward. The value creation principles, and there's six of them, at least five of the six of them are incredibly relevant. So still, you know, figuring out what problem am I trying to solve if I'm trying to do something new within an organization, exploring broadly what the options for solving that might look like. So we call that the exploration principle, because the challenge in particular in large organizations is people identify, maybe we want to solve this problem, jump on the first solution, and then just use confirmation bias to figure out why that's or to reiterate why that's the right solution, as opposed to explore what are all the different ways we could tackle this. And very often there are even more options when you're operating within a corporate structure off a resource base that already exists with partnerships and capabilities and competencies that are embedded in the organization. But people will attach to, oh, this is something that IT must solve, and we'll just give it to them. Or this is, we just need to create a digital dashboard and we'll be okay and we've solved it, as opposed to thinking broadly about a variety of different ways. And to get novelty and innovation, you need to push more broadly. So that certainly counts. Building prototypes, I think, counts and matters in a corporate setting and allows you to better sell your ideas, test your ideas, get feedback on your ideas in a corporate setting. So the majority of those value principles count or can be readily adapted to a corporate entrepreneurial setting. The ones that really are a little bit out of sync are the ones that I've put in the resource bucket. I think you can think about resourcing corporate ideas very differently to how you think about resourcing independent entrepreneurial ideas, because you've typically got a broader resource base to work off. You can go and pitch and get resources, and all you've got to do is show that you're moving the needle and hitting milestones, and you'll probably still continue to get resourced. So those are the ones that sort of disappear to some extent. And then I've got a principle called the trajectory principle, which is trying to understand what trajectory you're on as an entrepreneur. Are you trying to create a lifestyle business? Are you trying to create a growth business? Are you trying to create a revolutionary business? And appreciating which one of those trajectories you're on has massive implications for a whole lot of other big picture decisions that you make. And one of the mistakes I see people making is they want to adopt a revolutionary mindset for a lifestyle business. So, you know, that they're starting a coffee shop, but it's going to revolutionize or change the world. And that's just, it doesn't work. So that principle, it can apply in a corporate setting, but it's maybe not as relevant.
There's definitely an overlap there with the storytelling principle. You can see how that can go wrong from a narrative perspective. Greg, you've been so generous with your time, and thank you so much. I'm looking forward to navigating my way through the rest of the book. We'll obviously put a link to the Amazon link for the book in the show notes, but you've also mentioned your blog and various other places that people can connect with both you and your thinking. What are some of the places, or where are some of the places that they can find you?
Yeah, the absolute best place is just to search for me on LinkedIn. So part of being in the business school world is most of our students land up on LinkedIn, and I land up staying connected with them and communicating with them through LinkedIn. So that's by far where, a daily newsletter that I put out called The Daily Strategist comes out on LinkedIn.
Awesome.
And so that's the best place. And then, I mean, just for book purposes, I've been trying to promote it on a few other platforms, but primarily LinkedIn.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Greg. I look forward to see what will happen with the book out there. I wish you the very best of luck with the trajectory that the book is on. I see it being revolutionary and nothing less. And looking forward to checking and touching base again soon. Good luck with the career program, and hoping that I'll be able to see you either here or in the US soon.
Awesome. Thank you, Mike. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thanks very much. You've been listening to the One-Eyed Man podcast. I'm Mike Stopforth, an entrepreneur, writer, and public speaker, deeply curious about discovering better ways to lead and better ways to live in an increasingly complex world. I find the best source of these ideas is the experience and wisdom of interesting people who are taking unconventional approaches to solving the world's most compelling problems. If you'd like to hear from someone I haven't yet spoken to, visit mikestopforth.com, click on the podcast link, and send through your suggestions. A big thanks to the Solid Gold Podcast Studios in Johannesburg, South Africa, for making this production possible. And remember, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man / person is king.
You've been listening to another episode from the Solid Gold Podcast Studios.